And who wants to facilitate?
Okay, I think that's me. Derek won't be here. He's the other co-chair. I believe we have two co-chair elections today. Who knows where that'll leave us, but that's me right now. I'm at the helm. So happy New Year, everyone, and welcome. My name is Richard. I'm a council co-chair and co-chair of this community engagement group. Welcome back. I can go around and name some folks. We can introduce ourselves. Kat.
Pat Tajgir, Council Staff.
Hi, Kat. Kira.
Kara, Council Staff.
Thomas.
Thomas Noble, Government Co-Chair.
Hi, Thomas. Franco.
Franco Chevalier, Staff.
Hi, Franco. Laura.
Hi, Thomas, Council Member.
Laura Stephen. I think you're on mute, Stephen.
Sorry about that. Stephen
Hey.
Spano, the HPAP staff attorney at the AIDS Legal Referral Panel.
Hi, Stephen. Mark.
Mark Molnar, Council Staff.
And Lee.
Good afternoon, Lee Jewell, Council Member.
Hi, Lee. Welcome, everyone. So if we could, let's t look at today's agenda and we'll review that.
Pretty straightforward. We have the HCAP report that Stephen will be going over, and then we'll elect or re-elect co-chairs for this year. And then I'll have a very brief COLA update, and we'll also be voting potentially on a needs assessment target. And that'll take us to the
Thanks,
end of the
Kira.
meeting.
I wonder if folks wouldn't mind if we just switch co-chair elections with HCAP reports, just sort of start that off. And that way, if it turns out to not be Richard, that person can immediately seize control.
Ease
That okay?
control. Is that in honor of January 6th of a couple of
I
days?
know. I was like, no riots needed. Is that what we're
What happened to the
peaceful?
peaceful transfer
We can
of power?
model the peaceful transfer of power.
Exactly. Everything I do is in honor of January 6th.
I get
Got
you.
it. Got
Okay.
it.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. Everyone agree on that one?
Yes.
Okay. So we can approve today's agenda with that slight adjustment. How about reviewing November 6th minutes?
This is from November 13th, but it's still a community
Yeah.
engagement meeting that occurred.
Anyone have anything on this? Okay, we'll approve that. Thank you, Kira. Any announcements? I have one. I like to share my medical odysseys here. So 2 days after Christmas, I woke up at 3 a.m. in the morning with a searing pain across my midsection. I didn't know what it was, like really bad. Couldn't go back to sleep. So the next morning, it had kind of centered itself in my lower right quadrant, a little medical term I picked up. So
That's
I
not
didn't want to,
good.
but we listened to our bodies and I took a cab to General. And the next day, they did an emergency appendectomy on me. Doctor said it's not hereditary, anything like that. It just happened and it came really close to bursting. I'm lucky. So today's like day 10. I'm home and kind of feeling good now, just waiting for the sutures to come out inside and out. They're dissolvable, but yeah, amazing pain. And general was a long wait, but I was treated well there. And it's the first time I've had a general experience since my old days. And I was impressed with once I got back into the post-op and the surgical units, man, they've spent some money in that place. Top shelf trauma care and surgical units back there. Excellent nursing. So, yeah, that's me. Home now, minus an appendix. So, yeah, all is good.
Glad to
Glad you're
hear
feeling
you're
better.
doing better.
Thanks for
Thank
sharing,
you.
Richard.
Thank
And
you, everyone.
in the future, if you or anyone else finds yourself at San Francisco General, I live less than a block from the hospital, and I'm always happy to come over. If you're in a place where you want visitors and company, hit me up. I'll come over.
Appreciate it, Laura.
Makes me want to go to the hospital.
No.
Well, I will just share. I do love taking meetings over at Ward 86 because one of my favorite delis is right across the street at Newkirk's. So if we can count that as an announcement, it's worth checking out.
That's right, Stephen. You were the one who has told me the wonders of Newkirk because I haven't actually been there yet, but I will. I think about you when I go past it.
Okay, thank you, everyone. And on that note, that sympathetic note for your co-chair, we have possible elections coming up now.
Oh, they're not possible. They're real and they're happening right now.
So,
all right, I can jump in here. So we have two spots open. Of course, a person can renew as well. Anyone can nominate, including nominating for yourself. Kira, before we continue this, who all is missing from this committee, both like current and with the potential shift?
Can you talk about who we have on our list currently?
Yes, so we're missing Ed Chitty, Reyna Hernandez, Juba Kalamka, Derek Mapp, Charles Cerrone, and that's it.
Right. Number of folks missing. Charles, I think, although officially in this committee, there's no expectation due to health challenges that he will actually attend this meeting unless it's in person. And my understanding, Kira, please correct me if I'm wrong, but at least one of those numbers, Ed, is planning on moving out of this committee to membership. Are there any other potential moves?
No. So we have Ed potentially switching out.
All right, so we can get started on this, keeping in mind if we don't get both people, we certainly have more people who are currently not here. So with that, the floor is open for nominations or self-nominations of committee co-chair.
I nominate Richard Sullivan.
Richard, do you accept?
Of course, yes.
Is there a second to that nomination?
I'll second it.
All right. Thank you both. Any further nominations? There are two co-chair seats.
I'd like to nominate Franco.
Oh, Franco, do you accept?
Sure. Why not?
Franco, this is a very, very easy job. It basically is reviewing the agenda, sometimes helping to set or generate agenda ideas if council support is at a loss. And then between you and your fellow co-chair, figuring out who is going to represent this committee at steering. And so that's basically it. We send you an agenda in advance to be approved. That's the main thing that the co-chair does. Besides, of course, facilitate this entire meeting. All right. I don't know if I asked for a second. Was there a second? Is there a second for Franco?
Second.
All right.
I just want to say I have high hopes for Franco.
First like to know if any polyester died in the making of your coat.
Oh, Franco. Dear.
I'm not sure. I can check and get back to you later, though. Yeah. Hopefully that doesn't influence your vote.
Animal rights are very important. To...
Are there any further nominations? All right. Any opposed to the election of Franco and the re-election of Richard? Seeing none opposed, congratulations to you both. You are now committee co-chairs. And then please discuss amongst yourself who will be attending steering. I mean, a bit of a spoiler here, as Richard is a council co-chair, he does tend to go already, but it's up to the two of you. And of course, you're both welcome to attend. Steering is an open meeting, so that doesn't mean that only one person has to attend. Okay, and with that, back to you, Richard or Franco.
I'll run it from, I'll finish off, Franco, if you want me to, yeah. And, I love the history student in me. Derek Mapp deposed in absentia.
Boom, done.
Okay.
You miss a meeting, you're deposed.
Okay, so Mark, now we'll move to the HCAP with Stephen Spanos.
Thank you all so much. I'm glad that you are feeling better, Richard. I'm also glad that you had a good experience at the hospital. I will, per usual, I'll highlight a couple of cases that I think are, you know, of particular note or notable for one reason or another, and I'll make myself available to talk about others. there's also, there's one that, of course, I will place on the report next, month, but it all just happened within the last day, and resolved also very quickly. With a visit from the sheriff's office, but by way of briefing you, just because it's opened and closed at this point. There was a client that had a grievance, sent an email that, you know, this is a client who is English is their second language and also suffers from a significant number of emotional disabilities. Physical disabilities, traumatic brain injury. They sent an email out to a provider that was misconstrued as a threatening, and that got escalated to security for DPH. DPH was responsive. You know, I'm reticent to get involved in things like that. I feel like the security of providers is, you know, something that obviously is. You know, is paramount for everybody's best interest. But, you know, this is a client that really would not have been able to speak for themselves very capably. And so I supported them on the call while they were answering questions, and there was determined to be no threat. So, you know, I say that because, you know, for me, it was my first kind of foray into what happens after the fact. You know, sometimes if grievances, you know, don't go as planned. I haven't had a whole lot of experience with that. This is my first kind of time seeing how that escalates and how that goes. So I share that just because it's a new thing for me to experience. But I think in the end, a good result for the client and for the service providers. The first one up there was an instance. This is 2024-86, which is the first one that you're looking at. I basically received a phone call from a supportive provider who said that their client was given 3 days notice to leave a hospice facility. The only place that they had to relocate to was their home, which was really not a safe place for them to go back to. And part of it had to do with kind of violations of the residency agreement that also conflict with the licensure of the facility. I feel like this is worth highlighting for, well, because I think it's important to know that it's happening in the community, but also, you know, I do want to share the service provider's response was as compassionate as it as could be. When the license is on the line for a facility like this, where there really is no, you know, alternative or very few alternatives, you know, the community is best served by making sure it is available to folks. And if you know, something like that gets shut down, it puts us all in a very precarious place, like system wide. So this was an instance where, you know, the client kind of understood what the behaviors were. They had made changes to their behaviors to kind of to stay there for a long time. But you know, was also very honest about how, you know, what they were doing. And in this instance, when we're talking about like kind of safety issues already a little bit, in this instance, there is a little bit of a conflict between the state licensing requirements around harm reduction and the city policies and the DPH policies around harm reduction. And so I think it's important for us to know that there are kind of competing interests in that world. I think we're probably going to be running into a lot of those conflicts between, you know, our city and the stated purpose and, you know, kind of our stated goals and how we like to support folks versus how, you know, more powerful entities like the state or federal government are looking to do it. We're probably going to run into some of those conflicts moving forward. So I thought it was important to highlight that. The second case there that's listed is what I would call a success, even though it appears as though not a whole lot happened. So this was an instance where a client did have a conflict with, or they were feeling undersupported by a provider. They requested a new provider, and then they contacted me to kind of share what they were experiencing and why they had requested a new provider, and asked me if I could help them. You know, this is an instance where I have actually supported the client for a long time. You know, the reason I highlight this is because one of my goals is, you know, just like the whole business of HIV, right? Like one part of our goal should be to put ourselves out of business. And I do think that it's important for our, you know, for the consumers of our services to be able to self-advocate and to be able to resolve conflicts like this by themselves. And this is a client who I have practiced this with before. And it went very successfully. They self-advocated it in a very eloquent way, in a very helpful way. They had an advocate at that agency that also supported. And so I just wanted to share, you know, this is an instance where the service provider heard the requests, heard the needs, responded to the needs appropriately. And part of that has to do with a lot of the progress that the consumer has also made over the last couple of years of working with me. And so I just wanted to share that as a success. There's one other case that I wanted to raise up because I think it's important for us to kind of keep an eye on, you know, this is on page 3, it's 2024-84, it's the first one at the top. So we, I think, are all aware from being at, from hearing our updates from our colleagues in other districts, or sorry, in other counties, in San Mateo. This was a, this is a service provider who was providing services. Among them, they provided counseling services. They were also an ADAP enrollment provider. They went out of business, and the county for a short period of time took over those services, and did a very good job in the interim while they were looking for somebody to fulfill their RFP. The new provider has started, but in the interim, my client was informed that their client files were still on the premises of the former provider, the provider that went out of business, that is. And the only person that had access to that unit or that facility was the landlord. And so the client was very concerned about her and other, you know, clients' private health information, and personally identifying health information, as well as, you know, when you enroll for ADAP, that's like a social security number. There's a lot of kind of confidential and delicate information that can subject somebody to identity theft. So there were and continue to be some concerns about this. I will share the response by the county was swift and robust. I met with the county. I met with the city attorney. You know, my ability to provide guidance to a service provider is limited, right? I can't represent a service provider. And I'm always happy to field technical questions, and I'm always happy to support how I can. But in this instance, you know, this was very clearly like, you know, they needed legal support above and beyond what I could provide to them. And so the city attorney's office got involved. We have collaboratively kind of investigated. We continue to investigate. At this point, there's still some unknowns. We know that there is at least the potential that the client's information was discarded inappropriately. We don't necessarily have proof of that. We don't have proof of it otherwise, or, you know, we don't have proof of the opposite either. And so I've advised the client kind of appropriately how to protect their identity, made appropriate referrals for that. I do have a good referral for that if folks want to know. And that's not an HIV service provider that provides that support. But if anybody wants help with identity theft if they've either been, if they want to prevent it or if they have been exposed. There's a great resource that I have for that. And so I've already kind of connected the client to that organization and advise them. We're going to continue to try and reach out to the other people that were involved with the, you know, the old provider to see if anybody can give us a better understanding, but we're still investigating. So I say that because, you know, I mean, I share this obviously because I think it is an area of concern. I don't know how frequently it hasn't happened in my time, but to at least one organization, only one organization that I can think of that has just stopped. One organization besides this one that has just stopped providing services or gone out of business or shut their doors. But we're all dealing with information that's protected by HIPAA just by virtue of somebody's HIV status. So all of that stuff needs to be, protected, confidential, and you know there should be, hopefully providers have some paper trail of how they're discarding these things, at least in accordance with their policies. With that long-winded and a little bit of a chunky presentation, I will open it up to questions.
Anyone have anything for Stephen?
Thank you, as always, for navigating all of these things. You end up having to navigate such really thorny issues, and I appreciate your approach and your ability to try to get them resolved. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm kind of surprised that the PHI issue hasn't come up previously, or if it did, it didn't get to you, or, you know, just, yeah.
Yeah. You know, interestingly, I mean, there have been several client, you know, multiple clients that were potentially involved, and I've encouraged at least my client to encourage those folks to kind of reach out to me as well, if nothing else, but to tell them how they can protect themselves and provide some additional referrals. But I guess people have various levels of sensitivity around stuff like that. I do know people, even in the legal community, who simply just think there is no such thing as privacy anymore. And I'm not sure they're wrong, but.
Yeah, but we don't need to make things easier. For somebody, you know, like, I'm still not going to, like, write my social security number down on pieces of paper and hand it out to strangers on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Anything else for Stephen? Okay, as always, Stephen, thanks for your hard work. Thanks for sharing that with us, and thanks for starting us off this year.
Thank you.
Okay, everyone. Looks like COLA update, the COLA team.
Yeah, I can give a brief update about that. So our current target group is youth living with HIV. So we have been outreaching to organizations that offer services to the specific population, as well as organizations that we have worked with in the past. Unfortunately, we have not heard back. So we are just going down our list of organizations that we are able to sort of outreach to. So hopefully, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get something together, especially since this is on a much smaller scale than the needs assessment. So we trudge on. And that's all I have for COLA.
Okay, Kira. Anything for Kira on the COLA update?
I just have a quick question, Kira. Yeah. Which organizations have you guys tried to reach out to so far that have not responded by any chance?
So the one that has not responded is Instituto de la Raza Familiar. I've tried to contact a couple of people there. We have worked with them in the past, and we got a really good turnout of people for that specific focus group. So I was hoping that we would be able to work with them again. But yeah, we just have not heard back from them after multiple attempts to outreach to them.
And this is for youth living with HIV, you said?
Yes.
Doesn't, Thomas, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't Larkin provide HIV care for youth as well?
Larkin, yes.
Right, yeah.
So we did also...
I was going to say, I know you reached out to Larkin.
Yeah.
Right. It's the bread and it's the
right. Yeah, I was wondering, yeah, if they were reached out or not too. So yeah.
Yeah. So we did reach out to Larkin as well. Unfortunately, they were not able to provide us necessarily with like a list of folks that we would be able to recruit from. But I did send over our general flyer. So anyone who hopefully sees our flyer or is interested can go ahead and contact me.
And IFR has traditionally, actually IFR or MNHC, Mission Neighborhood Clinica Esperanza, I feel like that would be, the clinic might be a better route than the CBO. IFR traditionally is not necessarily an HIV kind of organization, but Clinica Esperanza definitely is.
I was also going to volunteer. I don't know what age range you're looking for when you're saying youth, but I do also have, I can think of a couple of patients that I currently have in my panel of Ward 86 that I know would probably, if offered the invitation and stuff, they would probably be potentially interested. And I'm happy to at least provide like the flyer. So I don't know like if there's a cutoff for the age range, because I've inherited some people from Larkin that are kind of close to that sort of like, you know, line of becoming young adults, I guess, by definition. And so they're still under my care, but they're still considered, young adults and youth, essentially. So, yeah.
I can pull up. I just sent the flyer to someone. I can pull that up really quick. But I can also send you the flyer, and it's our age range for youth is 18 to 24-year-olds.
Sweet. Awesome. I have a couple of patients that are like 21, between 21, 23. And also I can post a flyer at City Clinic. I know that we don't frequently get a lot of youth, but we do get at least like late teens, early 20s as well. So maybe if anyone is interested, they can reach out.
All right, perfect. Thanks, Frank. Sure. I'll go ahead and send you that flyer.
Kira, will you send me the flyer as well, please?
Yeah, of course.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, everyone. Needs assessment target.
Yes. So, this year, hopefully again, we will all be able to vote on a target group for the needs assessment that we'll be doing this year. And so correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, but I think the idea or the target group that we wanted to offer up for folks for this year's assessment is long-term survivors, was it?
I think, yes, seniors and or long-term survivors. Of course, there is a a difference between those two overlapping groups, but this is just a suggestion. I just noticed a lot of energy around the increasing challenges of this population, and we have not had a needs assessment for this population for a number of years as well. So I thought let's maybe just start off by throwing out that suggestion. Of course, it's entirely up to the group. You can come up with other populations. Populations should be, you know, as wide as possible. So certainly based on rather wider demographics than say a COLA would be. But that was something I wanted a council support to come to with a potential suggestion for you all. If you did decide to do that, you would have to clarify what you mean. If you prefer actual seniors, so choosing an age and moving up, or if you are choosing long-term survivors, you'd have to set a how long have you been positive. These are two overlapping populations, but they do have both shared and discrete challenges. So that would have to be clear. I think I was thinking less of long-term survivors and more of the senior population, because that's where I feel like I've heard the energy from when it comes to certain presentations. A lot of questions have been based around what does this mean for seniors and what are we doing for seniors? But that's not up to me. Anyway, with that, let's open up the discussion for the group as far as what you all think.
It's intriguing, I think. And I think it's important to ask if anyone here in the group needs any more definition of the differences. So seniors are what, 65 and up, and long-term survivors are anybody with a length of being HIV positive or having an AIDS diagnosis. And we might want to quantify what that is as well. So I'm going to throw that out to the group to make sure that everybody's clear about what the distinction is.
I can chime in also, I guess, from like a medical perspective, or like the way that I guess I personally sort of think of these specifically. I guess for me, when I think of a long-term survivor per se, doesn't necessarily equate to like someone, you know, that's sort of, I guess, older than 65, but more so that has been living with HIV for longer than 10 years or diagnosed with HIV for longer than 10 years. But I guess you can also kind of slice it in a different way, because it could technically be someone that was diagnosed before you really had like effective antiretroviral therapy, which I guess if you think back about like 1996 maybe or so, so someone that has been sort of like what I would call treatment experience, meaning that they've sort of gone through several different regimens and have acquired certain resistance to certain treatments and have warranted, you know, change sort of upkeeping with the new medications that are coming up. So that would be a long-term survivor for me. I also kind of on that same category will lump in people that have been born with HIV or acquired HIV, you know, through birth, because if they have been living with HIV their entire life, to me, that's also a long-term survival, I guess. And so I guess like maybe, you know, even though there is a lot of crossover in terms of like the length period of living with HIV, doesn't necessarily correlate with the fact that they didn't necessarily maybe treatment experience, because if it's 10 years or more, it could be 10 years, meaning that they were born with HIV and now they are 20 years old or something, and they have been in effective treatment and suppressed and all that. So I'll kind of leave it at that.
I also want to mention that this is just one suggestion. So if folks have other suggestions or ideas, this is definitely the time to gather that input.
Yeah. And keeping in mind too, that again, like as Franco underlined, like, and as Lee understands, it's these are two perhaps overlapping, but often not. Like you could be in your 30s and be a long-term survivor quite easily. And they have different challenges as well, you know, whether it's challenges from shifting regimens. Certainly there was a massive shift in the early 2000s. And then to like the comorbidities associated with aging, to the challenges around things like retaining and changing benefits. These are all different things that are with different populations.
Yeah, if I could chime in, Mark, I know that you just mentioned that this hasn't been a target for a while. And I think this is our largest demographic, correct? HIV, people living with it, is this group. I'm into that group now myself. And just to add, you probably already know this, but the community I live in, I live at 55 Laguna, but like 75, 95, there is a ripe population here that would be up. They're up for things like that too. There's always things going on in the community groups up here. I know this is a fertile survey ground up here for that type of activity.
Looks like Thomas has their hand up.
Thank you. I like the idea as well. I think it seems appropriate, especially what we've done the last 2 years. Long-term survivor can get political, so I'm a little bit nervous about that titling. And I'm kind of thinking what's our intent? Right? And so the needs assessment, are we trying to figure out the needs of population that we're going to select that are unmet, or that would help me a little bit.
What, can you say more about what's political about that? Like, do you mean how long, like where the line is between long-term survivor and not?
I've literally seen people fighting over, like, I'm a long-term survivor, you're not, energied. And it's like, are you kidding me? Like, there's plenty of room for everybody. And whoever, however we define it, somebody's not going to be happy with that definition. So that's what I mean, Laura, by defining it. Or I don't even know if there's actually a technical definition. And I think, Franco, you're trying to get a little bit at that with regards to medication failures, or, you know, did you take AZT or something along those lines? And
yeah,
I actually feel like from a recruitment standpoint, that might be a little bit of a barrier, but
I mean,
that was my initial thought.
And I think you raised a good point, Thomas, and I would just chime in and say that, like, there is a definition, I guess, technically, by, you know, like, sort of like the HIV treatment guidelines of what a long-term survivor represents, because it is a group, right? Like, it's like a diverse group, and they kind of lump all these, like, categories within the group. So I think if you're kind of descriptive of what that entails, like, if we're trying to be deliberate about reaching out to long-term survivors, explaining or sort of detailing what that means, one, to sort of, you know, to Thomas' point, to, like, one, be politically correct, but also, like, not offend anyone or cause any sort of issues around that, of, like, we're defining this as this different groups or including these groups for various reasons. And if you have a clear goal, like, for instance, I kind of put on the chat, like, if the goal is to understand what, if there's any particular challenges of navigating a chronic illness, like, so just like diabetes or HIV, like, if you've been living with it for more than 10 years, are there any particular challenges that seem to be sort of more prevalent for someone that has been diagnosed with HIV for more than 10 years versus, like, just newly diagnosed? Or is there any sort of, you know, one of the concepts that I hear a lot from a lot of my patients is, like, you know, pill fatigue or treatment fatigue. Like, they're just tired of having to take a medication after 10, 20 plus years. And so is that a legitimate concern that we should be addressing? Is there something that can be done around that topic? And so I think if you kind of target specific goals around what you're trying to do, that this could potentially be applicable to all of these different people that kind of get lumped into that group, essentially. So, yeah.
Looks like Stephen has their hand up.
Yes, Stephen.
Yeah, so I appreciate this. I guess I'm curious. I think I agree with the definition of a long-term survivor being somebody who didn't have access to healthcare. I think the definition can sometimes be, you know, extended to people who are not HIV positive as well. At least to a certain extent, again, navigating a very different set of factors, but still some very similar traumas. You know, personally, I've been living with HIV for, you know, over 10 years, but I would not consider myself a long-term survivor. But I also don't know that we need to get, that the needs assessment would need to get into that. I feel like it would be interesting to have folks self-identify, right, as a long-term survivor. And that would give us a better understanding of what is that political, because it very well might become coming from, well, you have access to more services as a long-term survivor than I have as, you know, if I'm not qualified, or, you know, it might help us to kind of hash that out and get to, you know, what the ultimate goal of a needs assessment is to find out, you know, what is it that people need. I also was curious, and maybe this is a more general question about the needs assessment and the types of categories. I heard Mark say that typically it's a more general category, but would it make sense to seek folks who are already obtaining a specific service or need, or already, we know already have a specific need? So for example, like, very not eloquent at all, but seniors who are aging in their home, or seniors who, right, because that might give us a better understanding of what folks need to safely live at home that they don't already either have a service for or have identified a service for, and then give us some, you know, advocacy goals moving forward with, you know, with the findings. It's a large group. This is a larger group than what I've heard other needs assessments have. And for that reason, it seems like that being a larger sample set provides a lot of opportunity for us to use it for other things. In the full council meeting, the last full council meeting in November, we heard from the folks at the Dignity Fund or at DOS, right? And that, you know, this is information that they would find helpful if we go down this road. This is something that would be helpful at their community meetings too. And so I don't know how specific it can get. I guess I kind of just wanted to throw that out on the table.
Sure, I can respond to some of that and maybe do some summation as well. I do want to make it clear that there actually are very specific parameters to being considered a long-term survivor. I know everything is subject to interpretation. Individuals might indeed have their own definitions for sure, and we should respect that. But there actually are specific parameters. I think Franco linked to them, but they are, as Franco has mentioned, you know, first and foremost being at least 10 years positive, but also around when you were diagnosed and et cetera. I think there are three of them. I have to click on that link. So that is specific. Again, we do want to respect people's self-identification as well, but that is something that we as council support would have to really work with rather than more openly saying, okay, anyone can self-identify. We'd have to work in within the actual parameters, much as if we chose seniors, we'd have to work within a particular age framework, or at least age floor. I do want to acknowledge certainly what Thomas mentioned, and that there have been, political is a word we could use for sure, or at least let's say community drama. I certainly remember various Let's Kick Ass meetings where this really was a big topic of concern about, like, well, who's in the room with us now? And that actually has come up a little bit at the council here and there as far as that sort of like that. Who is who? And like, I have a lot dealing with a long-term survivor, and how can you, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not saying we don't need to wade into that, but I do want to acknowledge that, yeah, there's just been some stuff happening all around for that. People have opinions. I think it's particularly interesting to look at either of those. Like, I really want to underline what Franco said around, like, this is an interesting way to talk, have discovery and to talk about chronic illness management. Like, that's in some ways one of the biggest things. It would make this needs assessment much more focused on the medical, right? For, say, a senior focus, I think you're not going to just get medical with HIV, and I think especially comorbidities associated with aging, but you're also going to get a lot of maybe wider information potentially about other service areas, whether it's benefits, whether it's psychosocial support. Obviously, isolation is a huge thing, and we keep on hearing that again and again with the elder community. So I think that's something that the group should consider. Do you want to, I mean, both can have a wide a large number of people for sure. But one might be more around a particular kind of topic, which is an important and valuable topic, useful. And another might have a lot of different things to process, which is also, I'd say, equally valid and exciting and interesting. So again, not trying to say one is better than the other. I do feel the energy has been more, as far as the council goes, more around the senior population, because I do hear a lot about like increasing isolation, increasing feeling like even though our community has the numbers, we feel more and more shut out. But that's just my impression.
I do want to add, obviously, like Robert Worry and the health department did this needs assessment around mental health issues in particular last year, which I felt at the time was sort of duplicative of earlier, you know, needs assessments and surveys that we already had. So I would want to make sure that anything we're doing is building on existing surveys and reports and needs assessments, in this area, and that we should really figure out what we're adding to this in terms of, you know, I feel like sometimes we go back and we ask the same people questions over and over again, and then we don't do anything, or we don't appear to do anything with that information. So I do think that, and I think my between the two populations. I think I would prefer us to look at people who are older rather than long-term survivors, in part because I feel like, and maybe Stephen can weigh in on this, but I feel like the service needs and service delivery needs are more similar across a set of people who are over 65 than it may be similar across a set of folks who are long-term survivors, regardless of age range, and particularly when it gets into things like coordination with aging services and so on. I feel like we may have more to say as a planning council around services for people over 65, for example, than for the universe of folks who are defined as or see themselves as long-term survivors. So of the two, that would be where I would want to go. And yeah, making sure that we are adequately building on existing needs assessments in this space, and we're not just asking people the same questions again. And, you know, I feel like we sort of sometimes we get into this place. I firmly believe in needs assessments and COLAs and everything that we're doing here. I feel like sometimes we sort of re-traumatize people by just asking them the same questions over and over again without any visible movement on our part at the Planning Council to actually provide any of the services that people are identifying as needed. So,
Thomas.
I would agree. I do. I am leaning a little bit more towards the senior energy versus long-term survivors. And then kind of building on what Laura's saying, for me personally, just I feel like whenever I enter into the conversation around aging with HIV, it quickly becomes kind of, I'm like, that's just aging. And so it's really hard to kind of parse out what is relevant as a person living with HIV and what's relevant as a person aging. And often I'm not blind enough to know there's a Venn diagram there where they definitely connect, but having as much definition so we can speak to the general population with regards to what are the issues specific to a person living with HIV and aging would really be helpful for me and my kind of movement through the world and advocating. And I don't know if others suffer from that same kind of frustration, not frustration, or just lack of, I don't feel confident saying, well, these are the issues related to a person living with HIV that are specific. So, and if we could ferret that out in this process, that'd be great. Thanks.
Lee. Thanks, Thomas.
I think, Thomas, you hit a conundrum that all of us with HIV, especially if we've been living with HIV for a very long time, and as we get a little bit older, it's harder to figure out what symptom is being caused by aging or what's being caused by medication or what's being caused by, HIV being present. I want to echo a lot of what Laura said, that we often repeat these groups in a way that we don't ever do much with it. And I think that's always been a problem for me. We kind of follow up with it before we do our prioritization allocation, but it doesn't really manifest in how we actually vote, I kind of feel. But I think in many ways, this is important. This senior group would be really important following up with the Department of Aging presentation that we just had, in November? And as they start ramping up services for the HIV community, the senior HIV community, what we do with this information could be then sent to them so they can pay attention to what we have found and they can incorporate it into the service delivery that they're kind of ramping up for.
Franco?
Yeah, I just want to also, I guess, support Laura's and Thomas and Lee's comments around sort of, maybe hyper-focusing a little bit more on like people aging with HIV. And I think that you know, at least for me, like when I think about it from my perspective and like my primary care clinic, I think about it for people that have been living with HIV for a while, but also people that have been recently diagnosed, but I also having to deal with other chronic conditions and things. And you have to also factor like things, you know, like there's a lot that we don't know, and there's a growing need and interest, I think, both from the medical perspective, but also from the social perspective, and really understanding some of the changes and things that happen over the course of time, either from different medications or just like being, you know, living with conditions that have been chronically there. I mean, how does that affect your bones? How does that affect your heart? And, you know, and like just recently, there's been a lot of hype, but specifically around cardiovascular health. I mean, like, you know, in the aging population living with HIV, just because like we thought wrong in terms of like how we should be managing that and whether or not people should be on cholesterol lowering medications. But even beyond that, I think just from like the psychosocial support too, you know, just in reflecting back in like some of my patients, I think that there's a lot to be said around that. Just like the feeling of like loneliness, just like feeling of isolation, and also just like lack of support in terms of like just like activities of daily living and just access to certain like things that people might need. And so I don't know, I feel like there's a potential here to really learn something that might be profound, not just for us as a council, but also just for to inform the community in general about what those needs are, because I don't think that there's really a lot of missing information around this area, and I think it's a population that definitely warrants more attention. So yeah.
I wanted to like the conversation that Laura started and that people are following up on, something to do with that. But first off, would there be time, could we kind of not come to an agreement today on something, but would it be too much work for council staff to actually mine past information, like Laura was saying, like other studies we've done or other assessments that this group has done, specifically to look for things that were issues then? And has that been worked on, you know, so we know where to look towards that and combine that information with what Franco was just saying, current trends. So on one hand, we could go through that information, see if things have been done on past sticking points, so to speak, from assessments that council has done. If we could sometime mine that information, take from that, and then also any current things that are coming on, like that Franco just meant. And then we can just always agree on, we can go over what the age cutoff would be and what the exact title and parameters of the group would be. But would that be too much work for council staff to go back and look at things like Laura was saying, and can they be improved on? Do they still need work? Are they still glaring? And combine that with current, I don't know.
I would actually, I mean, I understand where you're coming from here as far as like not wanting to like to actually have impact and certainly not to be duplicative, but I'd actually recommend against that. Richard, I do think, like, as we can see from the energy of this conversation, that this is a population that is a rich one, and that there's, no matter what, there's going to be a lot of information. We can still do that, but my preference would be for us to set the actual needs assessment target and then also do that. I think after we set the needs assessment target, we can do some mining. There's multiple steps that I think have to happen, maybe even prior to us beginning our interviews, but to start all this process, I do think we need to get it before the council. My hope, as Kira knows, was to actually start this process like from the jump in January, so we can have as much time as possible on this rather than sort of like processing the process, if that makes sense, you know. So we can still do all that, but it would be great to do that like with that target in mind, and knowing that the past is definitely important. The past always lives with us. But at the same time, like things do change as well. It might be a different group, different cohort entirely. It might be some there in the past. But yeah, I would definitely strongly recommend us choosing a population, hopefully at this meeting, and then sort of just to get that ball rolling, if that makes sense.
Well, then I will. Oh, sorry, Stephen's got his hand up.
Yeah, Stephen.
Okay. I just wanted to go back a second because maybe I'm still not understanding the focus of the how granular we get. A more pointed question. So, for example, would it would it be an appropriate needs assessment category to say people aging with HIV who use drugs, or people aging with HIV who inject drugs?
I would say no. I would say that is suitable for maybe a COLA. That's absolutely fine for a smaller number, absolutely. But for a wider needs assessment that's still targeted, I'd say that's gonna, it'll be interesting, but I think we want to go wider for our larger needs assessments.
Got it.
Laura?
I was just gonna make a motion that we identify the population of people over 65 as our target population for the needs assessment this year.
I'll second that.
I would second that, yes.
Great. Are there any objections to this needs assessment target from the remaining three council members?
So no objection, but I just maybe just want to throw a little wrench. And sorry, Laura, I just want to say in the context of the numbers of, because I'm just reflecting back on the reports from San Francisco and the numbers of people that are like living with HIV above the age of 50, I think. And they said something about like 60%. I don't know if maybe we want to maybe shift that curve to that number, or specifically 65. I don't know. Maybe I would argue at least 50 just based on that report, but that's just my, but if not, I'm okay also with 65 as well. Just wanted to kind of throw that out there just in terms of numbers.
Yeah, I feel like we quickly start getting into, are we just surveying everybody? Right, and I feel like the distinction between accessing services at 50 and accessing services at 65
totally.
Is worth getting at the nuance, right? Like, you know, both like getting people who are, you know, falling off of their private disability plans or... It, you know, are eligible for other things, and just the sort of accumulation of health issues that start happening at a certain point. I feel like it needs to be a smaller amount. I think it's still a good solid, what, like 40% of cases are 65 or something. So it's already still a pretty large group.
I was just thinking about the numbers, but I think just what you described in terms of like the benefits and just like transition of care and all that stuff, just thinking about insurance and health needs and whatnot, definitely agree. So no objections from my end. Never mind.
I had thought the number is 60, but since Laura just said that and over 65 is a robust group, I'm fine with that. Stephen.
I just wanted to share, because I happen to have it in front of me, what DOS considers a senior is, they consider older adults 60 plus years old. So I don't know if that changes anybody's thoughts.
I'm concerned. I'm 56, so.
You should add that to your list of concerns.
You're not already concerned about aging. I got bad news for you.
You know how you do surveys and they're like age 18 to 23, 27 to 35, 45 to 50. I only got one more group left. And like that's the 77 and then dash group. I'm like, I want to wait. Okay, so where do we go with this, Mark?
So I want to make sure, do we want to keep it at 65 with the new 60-year information? Whichever. Okay, I'm not seeing a suggestion to change it to 60, so we'll keep it at 65. Again, any opposed to this? No? All right, so we will bring this. So this is motion carries. Thank you, Laura and Lee, for moving and seconding. This will come to the full council this month. Now I'd like to talk about process. There are two very key steps, and now it sounds like Richard has added a third step, which is important as well, but two steps as far as this committee is concerned. One is like surveying, reviewing and updating, though it does require to be a lot of updates, I assume, with the survey mechanism, the survey tool, as well as just an open discussion of like where we need to go to and generating a list of contacts as well. Yes, Laura.
I mean, one, just a where to go to, and I will volunteer my colleague Vince and his team at San Francisco AIDS Foundation to help out with this. But secondly, and sort of picking up on some of what Richard was saying, you know, it would be great to maybe go back through the surveys from the last like 4 or 5 years, maybe, or maybe 3 years or something, because age is a category that, you know, we've had people are sort of saying what their age is when we've done all these surveys. So looking at the surveys from the last few years and sort of pulling out the folks who are over 65, or pulling out anything that was identified as a need for people over 65 for the different subpopulations that we've done, and just sort of use that as a, you know, include that information in any report that we're doing. Not that we aren't going to do this survey, but that we add in everything that we've collected over the last few years.
It's a great suggestion. So what I'd like us to do is in February to start, perhaps finish, if we have the time, the discussion of the review of the survey tool. I think that we're going to be looking at two external things, one of them being our own stuff around our past needs assessments and COLAs, and as per Laura, like what specifically might have been parsed out from that. And then per also suggestion, like I'd want Kira to reach out to Robert Worry and ask for a copy of his needs assessment tool. And so perhaps bring both. So Kira, you and I will talk about how and what to do. So I'd like us to agendize this for the February meeting and like really just get this ball rolling. I think we can get some good data and certainly some tool, at least Robert's tool, hopefully, by that meeting. If by some miracle we complete the review, unlikely, but if we do complete the review in February, the next step would be for us to do that brainstorming and figure out who we want to actually reach out to. We're going to obviously need your support. And you know what? If there's support groups that we're going to, or just sort of like ad hoc convening groups, I would absolutely welcome and encourage council members to support us in this. It would be great if council members were there with us asking their own questions and helping council support this community. I just think there's a lot of expertise and lived experience in this room right now, and we can definitely use it in our needs assessment. So if that process sounds good for you all and for my colleagues, Kira and Kat, we can move forward. That sound good?
Yes.
You're being unusually kind, Mark. What's up?
2025 New Year's resolutions. Be nicer.
Interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's working for the first couple days. We'll see. Anyway, great. Thanks, everyone.
So that looks like our meeting has come to an end today. First community engagement meeting of 2025. Great work, everyone. Thanks for your input and showing up today. And our next meeting will be February 5th, I believe, or February 6th. Yeah, February Zoom. So until then, see you in the Zoom universe and our other groups and stuff. Franco and Mark, could you stay back for a minute?
And actually, can the rest of my team stay back as well? I wanted to have a quick chat too.
Laura, a quick note. Last night I was part of the training group for the new switch from shift board. Lizzie Schneider ran the training. Yeah. And what a maneuverable site, this new site, really, for SAS.
Awesome.
It's just really nice site.
Excellent. I haven't done the training myself yet, but I have to, and she's been bugging me about it. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, really smooth. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Okay, everyone.